is a mixed public sentiment towards the Games.
One of the biggest sponsors of the Olympic Games cuts back. This is Wednesday, July 21st, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, rockets hit the Afghan capital during prayers. A UN warning about the misuse of surveillance technology. COVID deaths in India could be millions higher than the official government tally. A spider bite could save the lives of heart attack victims. Contact lenses could replace your smart screen. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Toyota will not be airing any Olympic-themed advertisements on Japanese television during the Tokyo Games, that despite being one of the IOC's top corporate sponsors. The extraordinary decision by the country's top automaker underlines how polarizing the Games have become in Japan as COVID-19 infections rise ahead of Friday's opening ceremony. Tokyo 2020 spokesperson Masa Takaya said at a news conference he understood the one-year delay after last year's Olympics had been an intensive and challenging situation for sponsors.
What I can tell you is that I know those partners and sponsors must have been struggling to support Tokyo 2020. As I said, it's an extra 1 year, and also that 1 year was a pretty intensive and challenging situation.
Being a corporate sponsor for the Olympics is usually all about using the Games as a platform to enhance the brand, but being linked with a pandemic-era Games may be viewed by some as a potential marketing problem. Reuters reporter Amber McCarthy has more on the Toyota decision.
It comes amid lackluster public support for the Olympics, with two-thirds of Japanese people surveyed doubting organisers can keep the Games safe during the health crisis, according to a local media poll. The carmaker also said on Monday that its CEO and other executives will not attend Friday's ceremony. Some 60 Japanese corporations who have paid more than $3 billion for sponsorship rights to the event now face a dilemma over whether to tie their brands to an event that has failed to win strong public backing. 68% of respondents in an Asahi newspaper poll expressed doubt about the ability of Olympic organisers to control coronavirus infections, with 55% saying they were opposed to the Games going ahead. As COVID-19 cases continue to rise in Tokyo, which is already under a fourth state of emergency, public concern has grown that hosting an event with tens of thousands of overseas athletes, officials and journalists could accelerate infection rates in Japan's capital and introduce more infectious variants. IOC President Thomas Bach is standing firm, however. He said he hopes the public will warm to the Games once competition begins and as Japanese athletes begin winning medals.
Emma McCarthy reporting. The chief of the Olympic Organizing Committee declined Tuesday to rule out a last-minute cancellation if the number of COVID-19 cases among athletes continues to spike. Toshiro Muto said at a news conference he is watching the infection numbers, with 71 coronavirus cases already reported since July 1st of people accredited to participate in the Games or be there in some capacity. Find out more about this story at voanews.com and our many digital platforms. These are some of the stories you'll find at voanews.com. The spread of the coronavirus Delta variant was reaching alarming levels in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi, on the eve of the Eid al-Adha Muslim holiday. Myanmar politician Nguyen Win, a senior advisor to ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi, died in hospital Tuesday after becoming infected with COVID-19 in jail. China to allow tax deductions for care of small children to help boost births. South Korean Paralympian missing after fall from Pakistan Mountain. China warns Lithuania over Taiwan opening de facto embassy. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. Rockets hit the Afghan capital Tuesday, landing near the presidential palace during prayers for the Muslim festival of Eid al-Adha, officials and media said, but it was not immediately clear who was behind the attack. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
Rockets struck Afghanistan's capital on Tuesday, landing near the presidential palace during holiday prayers. It's the festival of Eid al-Adha across the Muslim world, and despite the whistling rockets and explosions, prayers continued. The outdoor gathering included Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. Officials said three rockets landed outside the palace, but there were no immediate reports of injuries. Ghani later delivered a speech from an outdoor podium broadcast on local media. It was not immediately clear who was behind the attack. However, conflict has escalated in the country, largely spurred by the Taliban launching major offensives, taking districts and border crossings as foreign troops withdraw. Unlike some previous years, the Taliban did not declare a ceasefire during the Eid holiday this year.
Libby Hogan reporting. As the security situation in Afghanistan deteriorates, so does the situation for all other gains the country made over the past 20 years. One of them is free press. Afghanistan went from zero independent media to 170 radio stations. Now they are in jeopardy. Aisha Tanzim reports from VOA's South Asia Bureau in Islamabad.
In Afghanistan, district after district is falling to the Taliban. The militant group has more than doubled the territory it controls in the last 3 months. A very public casualty of this takeover, freedom of the press. Nearly 50 journalists fled to safety, fearing for their lives. More than 20 media outlets have stopped operating. Others are forced to broadcast Taliban propaganda. Najib Sharifi is the director of the Afghan Journalists Safety Committee.
We have at least five media stations, private media outlets, that have been taken over by the Taliban. And through these five stations, Taliban broadcast their propaganda. They have also stopped broadcasting of music and voices of women.
We only took over radio stations run by the Kabul government, since they were government-owned and we replaced that government. But private radio stations are allowed to operate, and we have told journalists to operate them normally.
Taliban denials and reassurances seem to be falling on deaf ears. Local journalists continue to flee as Taliban approach. Four VOA reporters have left their homes for the safety of capital Kabul. Pictures and some videos are all they now have of their life and work back home. Lina Shirzad had been receiving threats from unknown people. As a female journalist, her work was twice as hard.
I received a lot of threats recently, even death threats. They told me to stop working in the media, but I continued. I never expected that the Taliban would surround my hometown, and I won't be able to work as a journalist anymore.
Afghanistan was already one of the most dangerous countries for journalists. Last week, Pulitzer Prize-winning Reuters photographer Danish Siddiqui was killed in fighting. With the Taliban advances, entire districts have turned into news black holes. No one is verifying accusations of human rights violations from any side. And no one can verify claims of good governance by the Taliban either. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, rescuers have recovered the bodies of three workers in a flooded tunnel under construction in a southern Chinese city. And they're continuing to look for the 11 other workers trapped since Thursday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thank Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has issued a warning about the misuse of surveillance technology in the wake of reports spyware was used to hack smartphones of human rights activists, business executives, and journalists. Michelle Bachelet says illegitimate use of the tools could undermine people's human rights and subvert democratic societies. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
It is not yet clear to what extent surveillance tools sold by the Israeli firm Pegasus has been used to spy on journalists, human rights defenders, opposition politicians, and others. But Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet finds revelations that the telephones of some 50,000 people were hacked into extremely alarming. The High Commissioner spokesman Rupert Colville calls the emerging information hugely disturbing and notes it may just be the tip of the iceberg. He tells VOA the people whose phones were hacked are not Islamic State terrorists or criminals. He says they are journalists, human rights activists, and others engaged in legitimate activities.
It's very scary. The potential is very severe, and I think a wake-up call to everyone that we need to do something about this. We need to find some way of controlling this, of putting this genie back into the bottle, because it's potentially hugely intrusive and hugely dangerous in some cases for many of us.
In a statement, High Commissioner Bachelet expresses her misgivings about the use of these deeply intrusive surveillance tools. She says they can only be justified in cases of investigations in serious crimes and grave security threats. She notes if the recent allegations about the use of Pegasus are even partly true, then that red line has been crossed again and again with total impunity. Spokesman Colville says the surveillance tools reportedly have been used to arrest, intimidate, and even kill journalists and human rights defenders. He says the potential for abuse of this software is huge and very dangerous.
You can get people who are simply spying on any politician, on any kind of opposition whatsoever, in order to stay in power. And that, of course, is perhaps the most alarming thing overall. This can be used to subvert democracy, to subvert all sorts of human rights, freedom of expression, freedom of opinion, right to privacy, and in extreme cases, right to life.
Bachelet says companies that develop and distribute surveillance technologies are responsible for avoiding harm to human rights. She says they must take immediate steps to mitigate and remedy the harms caused by their products. She says states need to enact laws to make companies legally accountable for the illegitimate usage of their technology. She adds states urgently need to better regulate the sale, transfer, and use of surveillance technology to ensure it complies with human rights law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
U.S. President Joe Biden, his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga, and Russian President Vladimir Putin are among Pacific Rim leaders gathering virtually to discuss strategies to help economies rebound from a resurgent COVID-19 pandemic. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. A study by a Washington think tank is providing the latest evidence that India's coronavirus death toll could be millions higher than the official government tally. The NGO called the Center for Global Development says India has experienced 4.9 million excess deaths since the start of the pandemic through June this year. That means 4.9 million more people have died than would normally occur during that time period from natural causes, accidents, and other regular non-COVID-related issues. Not all of the excess deaths would be COVID, but some experts believe that counting excess deaths is the most accurate way to measure the pandemic's devastation. In the Indian capital, tattoo studios have seen a growing demand for memorial tattoos in the wake of the second wave of the pandemic that has claimed so many lives. New Delhi was among the worst hit cities in India, as Anjana Prasricha reports.
As she gets a tattoo, Rakshita Gupta says her father, who died from COVID-19 2 months ago, meant everything to her and her sister.
He taught us to be independent. He taught us to be brave. He gave us all the freedom we need. He taught me everything I knew.
The Guptas are among the thousands of families who lost loved ones during a ferocious second wave of the pandemic that shrouded New Delhi in grief in April and May. Some are now memorializing their loss in tattoo studios.
That pain is very internal and it will take time, but just getting a tattoo is like, it's a way of, you know, just putting it out there that maybe, you know, to us that how much are we missing him.
I don't know how to live without him, and I thought I'd want him to be with me.
Increasingly, young people have been coming to studios to get body art as a way to express their personality or style. But the growing demand for memorial tattoos is recent. They vary from phrases to images with a special meaning, like the identical ones these sisters chose for their first tattoo.
These are the angel wings, because he's our angel watching this over all the time.
For tattoo artists, memorial tattoos are more challenging. Some want to always see the tattoo. Others don't want a constant reminder of their loss. Either way, tattoos are milestones on the body.
Tattoos are like that. It's like your soul that you carry on your sleeve, what I feel. But at times it can be painful, at times it can be memorable, how you take it.
Moments of grief are often shared.
Sometimes they pour their heart out that, you know, they have lost. Sometimes I talk to them and know, you know, what they are going through.
At his studio, Lokesh Verma spends more time conceptualizing memorial tattoos than he did before. He feels they are helping heal a city swept by grief.
You know, mostly people who are very scared of pain, when they're getting a memorial tattoo, they don't even feel the pain as much. They are just thinking about that person whom they lost. So, it is more like a therapy to them, you know, and going through this whole ritual of pain and, you know, thinking about them and seeing their image or their signature or some their writing come up on their skin.
That may be true. The Gupta sisters are contemplating a second tattoo, also memorializing their father. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Making headlines in Asia, Japanese officials say companies were targeted by a cyber hacking group called APT40, adding the Chinese government is highly likely behind the attack. The comment comes after the U.S. and a coalition of allies accused China's Ministry of State Security Monday of a global cyber hacking campaign. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We continue on VOA Asia. Venom from an Australian spider that is one of the world's deadliest could save the lives of heart attack victims. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
A potentially life-saving treatment for victims of heart attacks has been found in a most unlikely source, the venom of one of the world's deadliest spiders. Researchers from the University of Queensland have discovered that the poison from the Fraser Island funnel-web spider in eastern Australia contains what could be a life-saving molecule or peptide. Known as HI1A, it could block so-called death signals sent to cells after a cardiac arrest, when blood flow to the heart is reduced. This results in a lack of oxygen to the heart muscles, causing cells to become acidic, and a message is sent for heart cells to die. Despite decades of research, scientists haven't been able to develop a drug that stops this death signal. Australian experts have said that's one of the reasons why heart disease continues to be the leading cause of death around the world. Dr. Sarah Scheuer is a researcher at the Victor Chang Cardiac Research Institute, which is part of the spider venom study. She says the discovery could also help transplant patients.
We're using this special little peptide with a small portion of a funnel web spider venom. But what we found is this peptide is able to help protect the heart where there's a lack of blood supply or blood flow. And we found that this can be used both not only in heart transplantation, so when the donor heart out of the body during the transplant process, but potentially could also be used in heart attack victims to help minimize the damage that occurs.
Australian researchers believe that the molecule from spider venom blocks the heart's ability to sense acid after a cardiac arrest, disrupting the death message. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
From smartphones to billboards, digital displays are everywhere. But some companies say the ideal display is the human eye itself. And they're developing some eye-opening smart contact lenses. Tina Trent reports.
We consult screens every day for information. But what if that experience could be delivered straight to your eyes? That's what some companies are hoping to accomplish with smart contact lenses. Lenses in which a user's field of vision is overlaid with digital information.
You can walk around with a heads-up display 24/7 in your eyes.
It may seem like a far-off concept, but engineers at startups are already developing smart lenses that marry augmented reality with everyday contact lenses. Michael Hayes is with Inwith Corporation, which created a prototype using a Bausch & Lomb lens.
We started from the safety and the efficacy of contact lenses as they are now, and then we worked out how to integrate circuitry into those kind of lenses.
Smart contact lens makers say their discrete appearance is a major draw.
There's no geek factor to it. When Google Glass came out a few years ago, people didn't want to adopt it because of the fact of the aesthetics.
Both Inwith and MojoVision's lenses work in tandem with the user's smartphone to relay information to the lens. MojoLens has built-in motion and image sensors.
It's all about eye tracking and understanding your intent. And when you're not interested in that information, it just disappears.
It'll likely be years before consumers can test drive these lenses, but the technology is already proving they're more than meets the eye. Tina Trin, VOA News.
Pastry chef Shimi Aron fell in love with babkas, a dessert that originated in East Europe in the 19th century. Aron started making his own, and today he's teaching others how to make this unusual pastry. Gina Dulot met with the chef to hear his story.
Shimi Aron was born and grew up in Israel in a large family with rich culinary traditions. But it was the babka, a pastry that originated in Eastern Europe in the 19th century, that he fell in love with.
You know, I was very fascinated with the aesthetic of it and the way it looked. And I thought, oh my God, I can dress it up. I can make it look like this. I can make it look like that. And, you know, this is exciting to me. I like taking things and improve them.
In the Jewish communities where the pastry originated, babkas traditionally contained dried fruit and cinnamon, rolled into an intricate swirl of dough and baked in a tin mold. Its name is Yiddish for little grandmother and is thought to have originated in Ashkenazi communities of Poland and the Ukraine. The pastry was created by adding cinnamon to the leftovers dough from traditional Jewish challah bread and baking it. Chocolate babkas didn't really catch on until much later. Right. When Ashkenazi families immigrated to New York in the 20th century, they discovered chocolate and all kinds of luxurious ingredients they hadn't even dreamt of in their homeland. These days, you can get almost any kind of babka imaginable, from cinnamon to Nutella to apples and even feta cheese. Aron is based all the way across the country in Los Angeles, California. His babkas have a unique West Coast spin, a little lighter, but just as full of flavor. For Aron, babkas are more than a dessert. It's a way to show his creativity, and the main ingredient required to make a delicious babka, he adds, is love. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, Los Angeles, California.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Chris Cascao, Amy Hybels, Keith Lane, Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy the day ahead.